This week on the BOAG World Show, we look at my top 10 tips for improving your calls to action. BOAGworld.com. This is episode 2 of season 10, and joining me as always is Marcus Lillington. Hello, Marcus.
Hello, Paul BOAG.
I don't know why I always saw the need to say your surname at the beginning, but I do.
Yes.
Well, I like to keep a certain level of formality with our listeners.
Exactly.
I don't want them to...
Right and proper.
Yes. I mean, it's like, I hate it at school. You know, you have schools where the teacher says, call me by my first name. It's like, well, I'll piss off. That's not right. A certain level of formality is required on such occasions. So now on, listeners have to refer to you as Mr. Lillington and me as Mr. Boag.
Mr. Boag. When I was at school, you got called by your surname.
Oh, you did? Right, as a student.
Yes, but not really. The sports teachers used to do. I wasn't that public school. I think if you went to public school, then yes, you were Smith and whatever. I can't think of another any surname other than Smith.
Jones,
there's another one.
Smith and Jones, yes. Yeah, no, so, I just like a certain level of formality. Hey, I hate the world.
Oh, shut up.
No, I do today. I'm having a real usability crisis that I want to share with you.
So this is so not going to be of any significance at all, isn't it?
It's a serious issue, right? So...
Right.
So I've just bought a new TV for a start.
Which, show off.
Oh, it's so gorgeous. 55 inches of gorgeousness. It's 3D.
3D's rubbish.
Well, yeah. I mean, to be honest, it's quite hard to buy a TV these days that isn't 3D.
Yeah.
So I didn't buy it for its 3D, but I've been pleasantly surprised. It's actually quite a cool experience. I quite like it.
Okay.
And it's got smart TV and all the silliness that goes along with that. But I've now once again got into the world of bloody hundreds of remote controls. So I bought one of those universal remote control things.
Yeah.
I've basically wasted half of today trying to set the bugger up.
Well, I remember when I recently got an updated Skybox, got the HD one, and thought, well, now I'm going to get the volume button working on this. And it must have taken me half an hour.
I know.
It does work.
Can you imagine configuring four individual devices to work with one remote control via the worst website interface I've ever used? And at the end of the process, it downloads a settings.bin file that you then have to drag on via USB. Oh, it's just not right. It's not right.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's because I was cheap. I didn't want to get one of these Harmony fancy gizmos that cost... I can't justify £100 for a remote control. It's just wrong.
Yeah, I mean, damn, the telly, I just use the Sky one. It does everything I need now. I sometimes have to use the telly one to tell it to look at the Sky box. Sometimes I don't, sometimes I do. And that's it, really.
Yeah, but then I've also got Apple TV and I want to control that as well.
Oh, that lives upstairs.
Yeah, it all just gets more complicated.
Yeah.
So our lives are just too complicated. First world problem and all that.
Paul, tell everyone, you're a winner.
Oh, I couldn't care less that I'm a winner over this particular
Paul,
issue.
You're a winner.
Well, you know how much I complain. So what happened was, at the beginning of this World Cup football thing, is that right? Is it called a World Cup?
You know it is.
I got that right, good. It wasn't the Euro Championship or something.
No.
No. Okay. So in the World Cup, everybody at Headscape decided to do a sweepstake.
Yes.
That I was forced into against my will.
Sweepstakes on this kind of thing are fairly normal, Paul.
No, it's like, I have no interest in football and you want to extract £5 from me.
Yeah.
For something I don't care about. It just offends me. It's like, why should I... It's not like I make you kind of... I don't drag you along to some sci-fi convention or anything and make you line up to dress up as a Klingon or something.
Not you that I you do that. That sort of thing, do you, Paul?
Yeah,
is this
all
confession
the
time now?
It's true. I would love to go to Comic-Con, but I wouldn't dress up as a Klingon.
No, that would be really sad. That Sorry for anyone who does that sort of thing, but very sad.
So you
your arguments aren't holding up at all.
You literally stole money from me.
We didn't steal money from you.
You might as well have beaten me up.
We invited you to join the sweet steak.
No, the amount of emotional blackmail that went on that day was beyond belief.
But anyway, you picked Germany.
I did pick Germany.
Germany was picked for you. You're out of the hat. And
yes,
you're the winner. Paul is the winner.
I am the winner. It is true. Well, actually, I imagine the Germany Football Club is the winner.
Germany Football Club. Excellent. Yes.
Yeah. They're the winner, aren't they?
Because they beat Argentina.
It's
football
like,
club.
I never understand this. Yes, we won. Well, no, you didn't. You in no way contributed to that match whatsoever. You know, it's like
people say,
club won last night. It's not your club. It's nothing to do with you. You are a spectator at most. You're a fat slob sitting on a couch pretending that in some way you're an achiever because a random club that you selected out of the hat happened to win a game. Now, how in any way are you contributing to that? How does that make me a winner? Hmm?
There were so many odd statements going on there. You lost me.
I want to know how me drawing a name out of a hat makes me a winner, because I did nothing. And as for football supporters, how they can take any credit for the fact that their team won, as if it's their team. It's ridiculous.
You won money, Paul.
I did win money.
In answer to your first question. And I guess if you support a football club like a city football club like, I don't know, Arsenal or Manchester United, then I guess you pay to see its TV channel or pay for tickets to go and see it live. Therefore, you're supporting the club. Therefore, you have some sense of ownership.
Okay, there is a degree of logic in that. I will accept that. Anyway...
You're a winner, Paul. You're a winner.
Yeah, I'm really excited.
What really pisses me off,
if I'm truthful about this whole experience, is because I was so indignant about being dragged into this, I made some rash statement about, well, I'll give the money away if I win.
No, you said, well, the last thing you said was you'd buy us all a drink.
Well,
that went down really well.
I know. So now I've won. I have to follow through on that, don't I?
You don't have to. It's your money. Do what you like with it.
I'm going to take £5 back. The original £5 that is mine, I'm going to take back and I'll buy drinks for people with the remainder. There you go.
Whatever you want to do, Phil.
Hey, do you want to know something really exciting that's going on in my life?
Go on, then.
I have an intern.
I know you have an intern.
She's sniggering behind me now because she can hear me talking about it. It's the best thing ever, right?
Is it? Does she bring you drinks of water and things like that, Paul?
She hasn't brought me any drinks, no.
And food?
No food.
And does all the shitty jobs for you?
She does all the shitty jobs for me, yes.
Yes, got there we go. Eventually. Got to the bottom of it. Yeah.
So she's doing all my editing for me. It's great. It's wonderful. I don't need to do anything. And she's having to try and extract information out of Chris Scott. Which obviously at the moment is impossible because he's, so many deadlines, the world's going to end.
What's she trying to get out of Chris?
Oh, information for, I'm going to get her writing case studies.
Oh, right, yeah, of course, there's two to be done, yeah.
Because you forget, that see Katie, who's the intern that's working with me, she's a proper writer, not a pretend writer.
Like you.
No, yeah, not a pretend writer like me. She writes for the TV Times.
Yes.
Did you know that? I think that's
funny.
I didn't
know that, no.
Why do I think that's funny?
Well, because you don't. Probably.
Because I don't. She gets paid better than I do for writing articles. Do you know that?
No, I didn't, Paul.
That is outrageous.
Can I suggest that you get her to talk to Pete and not Chris? We're recording this out loud, aren't we?
I can't get past the fact that she's paid more for. She writes 400 words and gets paid more than I do for getting writing 1,200.
Why is she your intern then? I wonder.
No idea. I think I should be working for her.
Yes, there you go.
Anyway.
I have to add one more thing before we actually do anything useful, or vaguely useful.
I've given up on it.
Vaguely
now.
Useful. Is that I had an interesting email this week, which was about the top 10 BOAG World themes that have been written over the years.
Oh, yeah,
they,
I saw that.
They were rated. I'm not going to go into it, but it started me thinking about, I wonder how many I've done. I haven't looked yet, because I'm in the office today, and I need to access my hard drive, which is at home. But I've already started by going back. I've kept this, the previous week, which obviously those people who have heard it will know this, I've kept the kind of intro and outro rock music, but I've gone back to the old divider. And I think I might randomly pick different musical themes over this series.
Oh, I like it. And then people can vote at the end.
Yes.
No, they won't vote. I mean, who cares,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I don't really. But anyway, it got me thinking that I wonder how many I've done. He made out that there were 10, but I don't think there are 10.
No, there can't be. Well, I suppose if you go right back to the classic episodes,
there might be 4, I'm thinking, but I've got to go and check it now.
Well, because at the very beginning, I used some dodgy piece of PodSafe music I downloaded from somewhere that wasn't created by your own excellent hand.
That was the only one, though. And I haven't got that one, unless I actually go back and download the original podcast, which yeah. I can highly recommend anyone does.
No, they're terrible. So, should we talk about this week's show?
Because
we've been talking now for over 10 minutes.
About complete rubbish.
About nothing.
Yes.
So this week we're going to, let's be honest, right? This week I've been lazy. Okay, because I've got so much on at the moment. Are you still there, Marcus?
Sorry, I was just nodding off.
I'm not used to going that quiet. Yes, because I had so much on, I've just used an old blog post as the basis for today's show.
Well, if it's good and it's useful, that's
fine. It is. It's the most popular post on my entire website.
Well, that's fine, kind of fair enough then. Although that kind of assumes that everyone's read it.
And it's also number one on Google for the search term call to action. So
really?
There you go.
How exciting.
So it's a really good post. And as you have guessed, it's about calls to action. We're going to talk about the 10 techniques for creating an effective call to action, which makes a lot of sense. You know, I think it's a really good thing to focus on. It's something that every website has. Every website has a call to action. Doesn't really matter whether your website is, you know, a personal website or a company website or a charity or a university. They've all got something that you want users to do. So that's what we're going to talk about. How to create those good calls to action. How to basically manipulate people into doing what you want them to do. Which, as you know, I'm a huge fan of.
Right.
Should we kick off with our very first technique, our top 10 techniques for creating a call to action? Here is number one. So the first thing I want to talk about is laying the groundwork. So that we're talking about, before you even kind of before the user gets to the point of doing a call to action, you need to lay the groundwork. And that's the first piece of advice that I've got about creating a successful call to action is to lay the groundwork. So before the user is willing to complete a call to action, they need to recognize their needs. It's always makes, whenever I start talking about this, it always makes me think of infomercials. You know, and have you ever seen, you must have, back in the day when you toured around America, you must have seen the late night infomercials that are on American TV. I just love them.
Covering what? What sort of thing?
Oh, you know, the kind of things like blenders. Because I've just come back from America.
Oh, yeah.
Blender can blend concrete. Why do I need it to blend concrete?
And basically they're more like TV shows these days, aren't they?
Yeah.
They have them on over here as well. My a good friend of mine enjoys watching them. I can't think what the networks are called that show them.
Like teleshopping networks.
Yeah, but basically it's like half an hour program, which is basically just to sell this gizmo.
Yeah.
And it's all, interviews and And, yeah, like you say, it's doing very weird things.
Yeah. But what I really like about it, they are actually, they're huge fun to watch. And they do kind of convince you. It's quite remarkable. This is a reasonable price, you know. You start off all cynical going, you know, it's a load of rubbish. And then by the end you're going, it's actually quite good, isn't it? But anyway, that's just my weak-mindedness. Yeah. Jedi mind tricks would obviously work on me.
Yeah.
But if you actually kind of look and analyse what they do something that's quite interesting and is relevant to what we're talking about, which is they first of all identify a problem and then they present a product that solves that problem, right? So, for example, a company. Let's take a company like Skype. Skype, they've identified a problem, which is keeping in touch with relatives around the world, you know, which is very difficult and very expensive. And so that, you know, and they provide a solution to that in the form of their VoIP software, Skype. So their whole kind of website and the way that they approach things is to kind of highlight the problem and then provide the solution to that. And I think that is really quite important. I think too often people jump into their calls to action without really first demonstrating the need. So a great example of that is social media. How many sites do you go to that says, follow us on Twitter? Mm. Well, why?
I was having a very similar conversation actually this week about a campaign site where priority number one was to ask people to donate. And I said, well, you know, you need to explain to people why they might want to do that first.
Yeah.
Same applies.
So, and charities are a really good example of that, actually. Where, you know, those charities, I mean, we've done it before when we worked on charity websites. So you go along and you go to the donate. And it tells you specifically, if you give £10, it has this effect. If you give £20, it has this effect. You know, and I think that's very powerful because it's a call to action, but it's presenting, you know, what you're going to get back. Is you're selling the benefits the whole time, you know. What are the results of you taking this action? And I think social media is a really good example of that, that you need to give people a reason to sign up to your Twitter account or a reason to follow you on Facebook, something compelling, and ideally you need to solve a problem for them. Anyway, that is number one. If we go at this rate, we're never going to get through this show. So number one way of improving your calls to action is to lay the groundwork. Okay.
We could just do three instead of 10.
No, because it's supposed to be top 10 for the top 10.
But rules are made to be broken, Paul.
No, I can't. Yeah, but I can't break it on the second episode.
We could just deliberately one week just do 9 and make out we did 10. That'd
yeah,
be funny.
Yeah, nobody would notice for day.
No, they wouldn't actually. Yeah, it wouldn't be funny at all. Anyway, so, carry on.
The next one up, on my next technique of my top 10 techniques is to offer a little extra, something to sweeten the deal to encourage your users to complete your call to action. So that could be a discount, an entry into a competition or a free gift, right? And in the 2008 Obama election campaign, they did the best thing ever, right? Which is, if you made a donation of $30 or more, they gave you a free T-shirt. And on the front of this free T-shirt was a bloody big advert for the Obama campaign. That's just genius. It's like, well, yeah, if you give us this money, we'll give you something back. That happens to be a massive big advertisement for us. I just think that's really clever.
Well, hopefully it was a nice T-shirt as well.
But
it was really, really cheap, wasn't it?
It's probably cheap and nasty. You know, and so that works, but the idea of providing some kind of incentive is a really powerful way of getting people to sign up with you, to agree to do. And it doesn't necessarily need to be something like a free gift or even a discount. It could be access to certain information, or it could be all kinds of different things just to sweeten the deal a little bit. And again, you can go back to infomercials is a great example of this, that they do, but if you buy in the next 10 minutes, you'll get this, this, and this as well. You know, and obviously that was all included in the price to begin with, but it looks like it's sweetening the deal. It looks like it's giving something extra. So that kind of thing works very well. So that's number two, offer a little extra. Okay, so number three, have a small number of distinct actions.
I've got to go back to number two again.
Oh, for Christ, you need to do this.
I was looking at something else, and then I was thinking about it, and then I thought, I think you've got to be careful when sweetening the deal that you're not overdoing it, that you're not kind of... It's obvious that you're manipulating people. I guess that's my... I have this... I hate it when, you know, like Booking.com and other holiday type sites saying, there's one person about to buy this thing, and if you don't sign up now, and it just annoys me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, there is a line, isn't there?
Yes. I mean, I imagine some people think that's great, but you think you've got to be careful. You've got to be aware of who your audience is, I suppose.
Yes. No, I will accept that. Now you can edit that, so that
no,
that
I won't.
Appears
no,
in the last
no,
section.
No, no, no.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Come on, you go, do your job properly, Marcus.
So yeah, you were talking about having a small number of distinct actions, I believe, Paul.
I was indeed. So it's, you know, I think the trouble is on a lot of sites we tend to have so many different calls to actions, don't we? Sign up for our newsletter, you know, follow us on Twitter, buy this product. All these things kind of competing with one another, and if you have too many, the user becomes overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. And there's a really famous study of this involving supermarkets, right? So they created a shelf in a major supermarket, and they did two different approaches with the shelf. On approach number one, they filled that shelf with as many different varieties of preserves, jams, you could possibly want. You know, every different flavor under the sun. And then they ran the same experiment again, but this time they only had a relatively small number of varieties on there. Mm. And what they found is that people bought considerably more if you only had a limited number of varieties. Because basically people were suffering from something called choice paralysis. There was too much choice, too many things they could do, and so they ended up doing nothing. Of course, the other big danger is that if you have multiple calls to action, that people end up doing one of your calls to action that's less valuable to you than another. So a classic example is with charity websites, again, where they have make a donation or buy something from our shop. Now, so people end up buying something from the shop, which is all well and good, and the percentage of the profits go to the charity, but they're not making as much money on it as if somebody had actually given a donation. So you've got to be very careful that your secondary calls to action don't end up cannibalizing your first, which you see all the time. And again, social media is a great example of that. You know, that you can end up with, your people will end up thinking that liking something is as good as, you know, doing some other call to action, which obviously it's not from the company's point of view. So reduce the number of calls to action that you have, because that will reduce the amount of mental effort people have to put in into picking the right one. And of course, that number of appropriate actions will vary from site to site. However, it's not actually so much the number of actions that is a factor in it. But the other element to it is that the distinctiveness of the actions. So take, for example, there's a wiki site that has three calls to action, right? Create a wiki, view a demo, and buy now. Those are the three options that they've got. And, you know, although three is not an unacceptable number, there is not a clear distinction between create a wiki and buy now. Which, what's the difference between the two?
I'm confused, Paul.
Yeah. Yeah, just shut up. You're being sarcastic. But it's true, isn't it?
Of course,
you know,
it is, yeah.
If you create a wiki, surely you're going to have to pay for it. Because there's a viewer demo option. Well, the viewer demo is the kind of demo option. So if you create a wiki, you're going to be paying for it. So, if they're not really distinct actions, then the user's left confused.
Microcopy, Paul. That's what it's all about.
Absolutely.
High quality microcopy. Well, in this case, just have two options.
Exactly. So a better approach would be to push the buy option later in the process and have create a wiki or view a demo.
Yep.
And then they'll come across the buy when they get to it. Mm. So that's the key. It's about having a small number, but also those being each of those being distinct. So I just want to make sure, Marcus, that you don't want to go back and say anything else about that last one?
Not yet.
You sure? I'm giving you the chance now.
Maybe in a minute or two. No, I have nothing to add.
Okay, that's good. Shall we go on to number four then?
Yeah.
So that's using that's about using urgent language, active urgent language. And this comes, you have to be a bit careful with this because this
buy into, now.
Yes, all that stuff. Buy, call, register, subscribe, donate. And again, this kind of comes back to what you were saying
clear
earlier, Marcus.
Language. Clear, I would say, rather than urgent, but
clear. Oh, okay, no urgency. The time limitation. You know, things like offer expires on the 31st of March, or for a short time only, or order now and receive a free gift.
If those things are true, then fair enough. But if you're using them as a way to make people sign up, which is what I always, going back to my annoyance over booking sites, because I don't believe them. When they say, someone's about to buy this, and you think, how do you know?
Well, I mean, the best example of it that I can think of is DHS. Is it DHF? DHF in Britain, which sells sofas and furnishings. They've always got a sale.
Yes, it's permanent sale.
Yeah.
It's probably so one day of the year that they don't have a sale. Probably for legal reasons, they have to not have a sale on it. It's probably Christmas Day, isn't it?
Probably. So you just don't believe it.
No.
It becomes worthless. It's like the boy that cried wolf, isn't it?
Exactly.
So, you know, but you can do some cleverer stuff with it. For example, I've seen a workshop once that creates a sense of urgency by offering a discount to those who sign up early.
Well, yeah. I mean, conferences have been doing that for years, haven't they?
Exactly. Or to, you know, say the first 10 places get, you know, a discount. Because often, you know, often it can be, so sometimes it can be time-based, it can be based on, you know, limited supply or whatever else. But it's providing that kind of, that sense of urgency for people to act quickly. So, yeah, that's another good tip. Which brings us on to number five. So we're picking up a bit of momentum now. This is good.
But we're stopping and we're talking about something else for a bit, yeah?
Yeah, it must be time to slow down now, mustn't it?
What's the next one, Paul? He says, looking at the next one.
Is get the position right.
What does that mean?
It's fairly obvious, isn't it? Position on the page.
Oh, right, make it big and in the middle.
No, make it big's a different one. That comes further down my list.
Okay.
But make it in the middle, yes.
Okay, we separated big and in the middle into
two. Yeah, because I have to get 10 out of this list,
right,
you see.
Okay, this will be a quick point, this one then.
So it's place it high on the page, place it in the centre. You know, there's some great examples of content that... I hate to say put it above the fold, because obviously there's no such thing as the fold, but certainly put it high on the page is a significant factor in it.
But that can go against the previous point about ensuring that people understand why they should be taking the call to action. If you put it too high and in the middle, then it's the first thing on the page, and then people would go, why should I donate or whatever, because I don't know why I should donate. There's a balance, isn't there?
Marcus, stop complicating things. No, you're absolutely right, of course. You do, you know, some of these points, you know, you have to weigh against one another and make the right decision.
Yeah.
Hey, talking about above the fold.
Yeah.
I was deeply upset yesterday. I really had to bite my lip because Katie talked about the fold and I had to resist the urge to rant uncontrollably at her.
Well,
I did very well.
Yeah, if you... It does exist as long as you kind of describe the situations where you're describing it. That makes sense. There is a fold on my screen. I'm looking at it now. That there is an area. If I'm looking at a page on a browser on my laptop, there is a point where I can't see the content anymore.
Yes. But that depends on whether you're running it in a window. It depends on the resolution of your...
But it's to say it doesn't exist isn't true. It changes is true.
I don't think the word... I don't like the word the fold because it comes from a newspaper and a newspaper has a specific fold point.
Yes.
while this is a point where things start to scroll. Which doesn't sound as snappy, does it?
No, it doesn't. Although there are some really nice things you can do with responsive design, as Dan and Ed did on the new Headscape BioWorld site, where the content changes depending on how deep the page is, for want of a better term. So it's not just left or right, it's up and down.
Do you know, I hadn't noticed they'd done that. I mean, I know that they've done it on client websites before, but I hadn't noticed they'd done it on BioWorld.
Font sizes change, basically. There's a point when it can't do it anymore, obviously, but
yeah.
But it does, you know, just sort of like... For the first few... I can't think of the right word, but as you're making it sort of slightly smaller than what you would describe as a standard view window, it just makes the typeface slightly smaller, which is cool.
It is very cool, but nothing to do with the point that we were talking about.
No, I can't remember what that was.
Get the position right.
Oh yeah,
I suppose it is vaguely, isn't it?
Yes.
Because didn't we do that with EDF, that there was we were having a problem on, so this is an environmental charity that we were working for, and we had a problem where the content was getting pushed below the call to action was getting pushed below the fold.
Yes.
So what you did is if the resolution was particularly low, then things were repositioned so that the call to action was pushed back up.
Yeah, it was all of the laptops they had at the time within the organisation were the machines that all the senior managers had, like these small kind of dinky little laptops, and it so happened that the design, when you viewed it on those particular screens, made it look like there wasn't any content below. Where you could see, that was the main problem. Because obviously if you see something's cut off, then you know that you need to scroll down. But it was kind of like, it just fitted perfectly. You could just see a kind of carousel design, basically. And then it was sort of just the right amount of space below it before of blank space, if you like. So we had to kind of come up with a solution to that, which was, as you just described, the layout changes at a particular depth of screen.
That's so funny. That really amuses me, because I'm pretty sure Ed was the first person to ever do vertical media queries, because this was a long time ago, wasn't it?
When yes.
Ethan was only first talking, Ethan Marco was only first talking about responsive design. And I love the fact that he created it just to keep a handful of executives happy.
Yeah.
An entire new technique that was created simply because of that. That's just wonderful. All right, let's move on to number six. So next one's blindingly obvious if you're a designer, but I think clients so often miss this, and it's the fact that if you want something to stand out, if you want a call to action to stand out, put lots of white space around it. This is where the power of white space really comes in. Because if you've got empty space around a call to action, it screams that. In the same way as when you go to the Google homepage, you couldn't miss the search box because there's nothing around it. You know, you just cannot get away from it. So it's not just the position of your call to action that matters. It's also the space around it. The more space around a call to action, the more attention is drawn to it. So the more you clutter up your calls to action with surrounding content, the more likely it is to be lost in the noise of the page. And obviously when I say white space, I don't literally mean white space. I'm talking about clear space, negative space. Space.
Yes.
Space, space. We're not space,
stuff
space.
Stuff with nothing in it.
Yeah. Except it could be a colour or a very subtle pattern, but certainly not other content elements.
Yeah.
So there you go. So use white space. I don't think there's anything else to say about that one.
Okay.
Talking about colours, another really good thing you can do with calls to action is to use an alternative colour. So colour is a great way of drawing attention to your elements, especially if the rest of your site uses a fairly limited palette. So if the majority of your site is going to be using, say, blue, then using a bright orange button is really going to stand out from that. So there's a Mac application called Things that does this. Not that I've looked at their site particularly recently.
So it's probably nothing like that now, is it?
I read this article a long time. It's not, actually. I've just looked.
All,
it's nothing.
They've gone all kind of animated-y. or not, no, illustrated.
Illustratively. But anyway, the site used to be, you know, almost exclusively blue, but then there were these two massive, kind of, not massive in size, but in contrast, orange buttons that were download and make a purchase. Mm. And actually, I think they've kind of lost that a little bit on their current site.
Definitely,
I think,
yeah.
You know, it's not got that punch that it once had, and it is harder to spot the calls to action. So, contrast, colour contrast is a really great way of grabbing somebody's attention and drawing it to a button. I have to say mine, because otherwise someone will tell me off. You can't rely on colour alone, because obviously a lot of users are colour blind. So you're going to need to kind of combine colour with other techniques that we've talked about as well in order for this to work. Okay, let's move on to number 8. So this is your one, Marcus.
Make it big.
Make it big. Yes.
Make it big, put it in the middle. End of episode.
It's the American approach to web design. Make it big.
Well, I know we're kind of like taking the mick a bit here, but I'm a massive fan of keep content on a page to a minimum, step people through, which basically is make it big.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as web designers, we often get annoyed when clients ask us to make things bigger. Mm. But I think, you know, and okay, it's true that size isn't everything. but I do think that, you know, making it large does make a difference. It is a big part of it. And I think we often, you know, we want to be subtle in our design, don't we? But actually, subtle is not everything. I mean, a great example of this that I really like is the Firefox website. If you go to mozilla.com, right, they've got this frigging massive button.
Yep.
You know, download Firefox. No messing around. Right in the centre of the screen. Lots of white space around it. Colour contrast. You know, job done. And I do think sometimes as designers we try and be too subtle and too clever when we should just put a bloody big button there. Okay, so we come on to number 9 now. Nearly made it, Marcus. See, aren't you proud?
You're doing so well.
I know. So number 9 is have your calls to action on every page. What, there seems to be this thing about putting calls to action on home pages, and then people kind of lose interest on the rest of the site, which I find hugely bizarre. But every page, I think, on your website should have some form of call to action to lead the user on. I think if the user reaches a dead end, then they're going to leave without responding to your call to action. Now, I'm not saying it needs to be your main call to action on every page of the website. I'm not saying you should just shove it in the header or the footer. What I'm saying is that every page should lead you on in some way to the next thing.
No dead ends.
No dead ends, yeah. You know, so you can have smaller actions on some pages that lead the user gently on towards their your ultimate goal, but it should always lead you somewhere. 37 Signals used to do this in a really good way on their website. They used to have calls to action to take a tour or sign up for a Basecamp account on every single one of their Basecamp pages. And it left you in no doubt what you were supposed to do and where you were supposed to go next and what the ultimate aim of that site was. And I actually think more people should be taking that kind of approach and thinking about every page and what the call to action is. And so we come to point number 10. Is it just me, or does it feel like this podcast has been going on for days, Marcus?
Days and days. Over a week, actually.
Do we confess our sins at this point?
Yeah, I mean, you were very apologetic, but I'm sure you didn't do it deliberately, Paul. Paul chopped off this bit of the recording.
Yes, so we've had to revisit it.
Yes.
It probably comes down to the fact that the app crashed because I'm using Yosemite, the new operating system.
Of course, that's exactly what it'll be, so it is your fault.
So it is my fault, and you can be pissed at me. So there you go, that cheers you up. So anyway, we're coming on to the final point in our extensive list of calls to action and how to do good calls to action. The final one comes about carrying your call to action through. I'm amazed at how many sites have like really strong calls to action on them. And then you click and you kind of go through to that call to action. And it's actually it just kind of dumps you. It's interesting. I've been reviewing a higher education website, haven't I, Marcus?
You have.
Making me do work, which is disgraceful. And as part of that, they've got this big call to action on their on every page. Well, it might be every page or their homepage anyway, which is, you know, attend an open day.
Mm.
And you click on this attend an open day, and instead of telling you about this open day, it literally just takes you to a registration form. There's no kind of additional information, no explanation, nothing. Just here's a registration form, sign up. And you see that quite a lot. And I think it's really important that you kind of follow through more thoroughly with a landing page or whatever is required to make things clear as to what you're trying to do. But when you inevitably come to that point of, you know, the user filling in their details or whatever, I'm also horrified at how many fields many sites like you to fill in. You know, sign up for our website, you know, or our newsletter, yeah, or whatever. So why do you need to know what sector I work in for me to sign up for a newsletter, or my dog's inside leg measurement, or whatever bizarre thing that they seem to try and collect these days? I think it's basically because marketing people like to build up demographic information, which is kind of fine, and I can understand the desire to do that, but, you know, people end up dropping out of the process because they can't be asked. If you do want to do that kind of thing, I suggest waiting until the end of the process, get the minimal information you require, and then, you know, ask for some additional information if you really need it. That's kind of my attitude, but hey.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. It's a bit like the kind of donation process, isn't it? Or if you're signing up to become a member of something, don't ask people for an additional donation until they've signed up.
Yes, that's absolutely. One. Because, you know, you're just looking like you're taking the piss, basically, aren't you?
What I've found a fair amount, particularly again in the HE sector, is if you're asking people to apply for something or whatever, sign up for something, you tend to find, well, there's a noisy plane going past. I've got my window open for a change. Because it's so hot.
It is so hot.
Which just makes a change for us moaning about the cold and wet weather. It's really hot at the moment in England. Anyway, what was I talking about? Oh, yes. You tend to find that there are certain courses or whatever that fit the bill nicely with, yes, apply for this, and then you get taken through to the, you know, the well-designed, good usability process of signing up for applying or whatever. But you'll find that some courses don't fit that. Hmm. So rather than dealing with them sensibly, they just kind of fire you back to the sort of homepage or landing page for courses or something, and you feel completely lost. So
one that I came across recently, again, same site I was mentioning a minute ago. You go into some of the course pages on that website, and they've obviously tried to introduce some kind of consistency in the sub-navigation. So each course has the same sub-navigation down the side of it.
Yep.
Except that, and one of those options is, you know, how to apply, and another one is apply now. Unfortunately, on some courses, there isn't that information because it hasn't been supplied or isn't possible or whatever. And so instead of removing the options, they've just made them unclickable. So I sat there going, why isn't this working? Oh, it's because I'm using Yosemite and it's buggy. And then eventually worked out, no, it's the site has a link that doesn't link anywhere.
Helpful.
So that was a particularly weird one. So you get all kinds of peculiarities, don't you? And you just got to kind of follow through and finish off. Otherwise, you know, you're wasting your time, aren't you, really?
Mm-hmm.
So that is our top 10 tips for effective calls to action. Marcus, do you have a joke to finish off the show with?
I do have a joke, and obviously, Paul, you know the punchline.
Oh, yeah. Are you just going to do the same joke? I would have thought you'd at least find a new joke.
No, because this is a good one.
Okay, go on then.
You have to pretend not to have heard it
before. Well, let's be honest. I've almost certainly completely forgotten it, as I barely can remember my name from day to day.
Okay. A man takes his cross-eyed dog into the vets and asks him what he could do for poor old Rover. The vet says, I'm going to have to put him down. The man exclaims, why? Because he's cross-eyed? No, the vet says, because he's heavy.
I had forgotten that, and it is a good one. I like that.
That is good, isn't it? I said that to my wife and other people, and they go, I don't get it.
Oh.
It's like, what?
So it must be my razor-sharp intelligence. Hey, so I've got a little treat for the listeners when we before we finish up. So, as people probably know, I've been involved with the future of conferences for flipping years. And on the 29th of September to the 1st of October this year, there's the Future of Web Apps London. And they're kind of really changing it around. They're doing loads of new stuff, and they've got loads of tips and tools for developers, and they're talking about APIs and toolkits and lots of techie stuff that, to be honest, I don't understand, right? But because I love the guys at Future Of so much, I decided to do them a favour. And I thought, using our massive audience of six people that listen to this show, you know, I thought I would get the word out for them about this conference. So there is a 15% discount if you want to attend the conference using the code HEADSCAPE15. We don't make any money out of this. I'm doing it purely out of the deep love that I have for the guys at that conference. So if you fancy going along and checking it out, then you can use that code. I'll put a link in the show notes to the Future of Web Apps so that you can get to it that way. But a quick Google will do the job as well. So if you are in London and you can do a conference on the 29th of September, then definitely check this out. It is worth one looking at. And yeah, they normally have some great speakers and interesting subjects and stuff. So there you go. Okay, I think that about wraps up this week's show. I wish all shows were as short as this for us recording them. Barely have we started that we're now finishing.
Indeed.
Perhaps that's the way to do it. Perhaps we just record a little bit of the show each day. That won't be in any way disjointed.
No, or difficult, or painful, or annoying.
No, so perhaps that isn't the best idea. But anyway, I can guarantee that next week's show is going to be a good one, because we're about to record it, and I'm in such a happy, jolly mood today. Yeah. And it's going to be our top 10 books that every web professional should read. So check that out next week.